Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Spin Rate, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. That's right. This is Spin Rate, the Athletics Toronto Blue Jays podcast. My name is Drew Fairservice, and welcome to the first off-season edition of Spin Rate. We got a lot to talk about, I think. There's a very interesting off-season on the horizon. You can't see me right now, but I'm doing like the look on the horizon thing with my hands over my eyes, trying to keep the sun, because the Blue Jays have a lot of things to do this off-season. So let's consider this the off-season primer episode of Spin Rate. And there is no person who is more primed for the off-season, who is more in need of a break, as well as ready to go and break it all down, than the co-host of Spin Rate. She covers the Toronto Blue Jays for The Athletic. Her name is Caitlin McGrath. Caitlin, welcome.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yes. Happy Thanksgiving. It is Thanksgiving here in Canada. If you don't know, your name is Rob and you live in New Jersey and you're listening to this, and it is Canadian Thanksgiving, which comes less than 2 weeks after the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. And apparently we did not spend enough time thinking about it, because now we're all like, Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Look at all these goddamn turkeys and gourds. I've been trying to think a little bit differently about Thanksgiving this time around. And I saw a very interesting thing on TikTok, actually maybe like an hour ago, that has, even I was like, maybe we can call it like the harvest celebration. Mm-hmm. This guy on TikTok was like, yeah, I get that. But also part of the reservation system was moving Indigenous people off of the lands that they had traditionally, looked after, lands that, you know, rivers that they fished, places where they grew food, and were moved, and where they had to learn, you know, relearn lands, and moved into areas that weren't as often as fertile. So celebration of harvest is like, thank you for the harvest for the land that we stole. So it's just kind of, it's, maybe I would say it's sticking in my craw a little bit, just trying to think about these things in ways that I hadn't before, as is my privilege to just blithely wander through life. Being like, pumpkin pie, baby, let's go, as opposed to whatever else. And with that, I want to do the housekeeping bit where I say, make sure you subscribe to Spin Rate, because we go on weird tangents, usually at the end of the show, but sometimes at the beginning, about the meaning of Thanksgiving.
People but most are going to check. They're going to say, what podcast am I listening to again?
You're listening to Spin Rate. And you should subscribe if you haven't already. This is your first time. If you're like, I need to know what's going on with the Blue Jays this offseason, I need an offseason primer, I would say, I've got a primer for you. Let's get primed for the Blue Jays offseason. And also, let's reconsider what it means to celebrate Thanksgiving in a time of harvest and bounty in a world, in a country that was stolen from the people who lived here for generations before any white person ever stepped foot. You can also subscribe, of course, to The Athletic. If you go to theathletic.com/spinrate, you can get hooked up for a whole year. They'll give you a tidy deal. And that way you'll get everything that Caitlin writes, whether she's on vacation or otherwise. If the news breaks, Caitlin will be there with bells on, breaking it down. There are signings, there are rewards, there's so much to talk about this coming off season. So, and we can also even talk a little bit about the playoffs that have been going on. Of course, since last we spoke, the Yankees out, sent packing by the Red Sox. A battle of two frauds. The least fraudulent rose to the top. And now that same fraudulent band of Red Sox are maybe on the way to ushering out the Rays. At the time of us recording here right now, it is 5-1 Boston in game four of a series that those Red Sox lead 2-1. Have you been watching the playoffs, Caitlin?
Yeah, I have not been watching it completely thoroughly, but I've watched enough of it to know what's happening. I was pretty certain that the Red Sox were going to win that wild card game. Just watching the two teams, knowing how Fenway can play, knowing the Yankees, sometimes their offense can come up short. And generally speaking, Boston's offense tends to be their team strength for them. I don't know. I just kind of wasn't. And like I saw a lot of, you know, Baseball Insiders or whoever picking the Yankees to come out of that game. But yeah, I was not really surprised to see it was the Red Sox. They're just, and you've talked about this constantly, is like every time you think the Red Sox are just going to bow out, they don't. Like they just, you know, they are, I don't know that you can, you know, measure this or anything, but like they just seem to be kind of a charm team this year. Like they just kind of get knocked down a little bit, but they don't get knocked down completely. And then they find ways to win. And like they are playing really well against the Rays, and they won that game big after they went down early. And you thought it was like, you know, Chris Sale was out of the game, and you thought it was like kind of spelling, you know, the end for them. And they came back, and yeah, they look pretty well situated right now, although it's just the sixth inning as we're recording, so we'll see what happens.
Shout out to great Canadian Nick Pivetta, who pitched his Canadian ass off, throwing four innings of high leverage relief. Just absolute incredible performance. Just the thing that everyone has been expecting from Nick Pivetta for so long. Who looked, you know, for as such a talented pitcher who was never really able to kind of put it together. And then I saw Craig Goldstein, who's been on the show before, saying like, oh, I get it now, right? Like watching Nick Pivetta being like, for so long, people have been like, no, he's going to take this step forward. He's got so much, his so toolsy. His pitches have, he's got so much to offer, that high fastball, high, you know, then the curveball thing. But he just looked awesome. So shout out to Nick Pivetta, and shout out to the Rays for after watching game one. I was like, okay, well, this is it, right? Like the Rays are not there. They looked so good. And then the pitching has abandoned them. Somebody else I saw made a point. Everyone who listens to this show knows that what was their record against the Orioles this year? 18-1. Somebody made a point that they beat between the Orioles, the Angels, might have been the Mariners and Cleveland. They were like, this is a guy named Ben that I follow online who said something like they were 35-4 against those teams. And then like 65-58 against everybody else, which is like not uncommon for good teams. Like the Blue Jays beat up on the Orioles, the Red Sox beat up on the Orioles, other than the Yankees. Everyone kind of had their way with them. But I just wonder about the way that the Rays are just reliever, reliever, reliever. By the time you get to the end of the season, it can be maybe tough to win that way in the playoffs. I don't know. They made it to the World Series last year in what was a weird and shortened season, but starting pitching has an outsized role in the playoffs. I think that much is a settled science, I guess we could say. So when the Rays don't have, you know, missing, what's that big kid with the hair, Tyler Glasnow, they're at a bit of a disadvantage because they don't have those starters that they can rely on. Of course, neither do the Red Sox. Who's pitching well for the Red Sox? Nobody. And on the other side, the White Sox decided they were going to show up and give the Astros a bit of a series. So at this point, they were rained out here today on Monday when we were recording. And that series is 2-1 for Houston. And in the National League, Milwaukee stumbling a little bit in their series against Atlanta. And then the blessed Giants and Dodgers series. It's going on and looking like a lot of fun. Also, I was watching Max Fried pitch the other night, and he looked so good. Mm-hmm. Max Fried pitched really, really well. We'll be right back with more Spin Rate, but first, check this out.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hey,
it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Caitlin, let's talk about the Blue Jays, who did not make the playoffs, even though they're probably the better of those three or even four teams in the American League East. You don't have to twist my arm to get me to say that out loud. But they're not playing right now. But they do have lots of stuff coming up in the offseason. You've written a few different things. Maybe we'll use them as like source materials.
Okay.
Source material. So number one, let's talk about what are there any big dates coming up or anything that's going to keep kind of Blue Jays fans can think about in terms of the order of that we can expect to see things happen here through the offseason?
Yeah. So everything sort of follows the conclusion of the World Series at this point. So teams can do little things. I mean, if teams, you know, want to fire their manager or whatever, they kind of can do that right now. But generally speaking, other transactions and whatnot, any sort of major transactions are kind of held until the conclusion of the World Series. And so that when the World Series ends, the day after is basically when free agency opens up. But of course, there's that 5-day window where teams are allowed to negotiate exclusively with their own free agents. It's known as the quiet period. You know, sometimes teams can lay some groundwork during that time, but I think typically it's not really seen as a time where a lot of action takes place. And then, you know, it's also a time period where teams have to decide whether they want to extend a qualifying offer to any of their free agents who are eligible for it. So that is something that the Blue Jays will be thinking about. There's two guys that I think are going to almost certainly get qualifying offers. There's one guy who is probably on the bubble. So Semien and Robbie Ray will almost certainly get a qualifying offer for the Blue Jays. That gives the Blue Jays protection. If they sign elsewhere, they get those compensation draft picks back. And I think the guy that's on the bubble who's more of an interesting case would be Steven Matz. The way he pitched this year, I think you could make sort of the argument that maybe he pitched well enough to earn a qualifying offer. We're not sure what the value of that is, but typically in the last couple of seasons or off seasons, it's been anywhere between $17 million and almost $19 million. And it's a one-year deal. And so his is an interesting case. I'd be interested in hearing what you think about that, just knowing that we kind of are both assuming that Robbie Ray and Semien are going to get those offers, reject them because they want to go to free agency and make a lot more money than $20 million.
I don't think that is speculative on either of our parts to assume that Robbie Ray and Marcus Semien will both receive and then turn down the qualifying offer. Which is, you know, Steven Matz is an interesting case because Steven Matz is the guy that thing works against often the mm-hmm. most. He's very much in baseball's middle class, as much as a middle class person can earn $18 or $19 million for a year's work. But I think that it's a worthwhile gamble for the Blue Jays to offer him it. My thinking. So as you were describing it, I was kind of like kicking the ideas around in my head. I think because it's almost like they're playing chicken.
Yeah.
But I think if they offer it to him, he'll accept it. And if I'm the Blue Jays, I'm happy with that.
So like I was writing this about this a couple days ago, and like, you know how FanGraphs has that like sort of value at the bottom where it kind of estimates based on the player's war what their value is. And so what Steven Matz did in 2021 season, it was like 2.8 War, Fangraphs War, and that was worth about $22 million. So if you're assuming that the qualifying offer is coming in around like $19 million, let's say, and he was to repeat what he did in 2021, you're getting, if you're the Blue Jays and he accepts, you're getting excellent value on him. He could also look at that and say, I'm worth more than, and that's an interesting, because like, as you say, it's kind of right on, right at the level of Eddie's at. If he's a $20 million pitcher and it says his value is about $22 million, whatever, give or take, and the qualifying offer comes at $19 million, it is like a game of chicken, because there's a fair argument to say he will accept it, and if you're the Blue Jays, you're fine with that. There's also an argument where he could say, you know what, I think I'm worth a little bit more than that, and I'm only going into my age 31 season, and I think I can get 2 or 3 years, and I want to take the gamble. And the gamble is, of course, what that qualifying offer hangs on a player like him, is that draft pick, right? And we've seen the Blue Jays sort of not be afraid of that. Like Springer had one, didn't really stop them. And so there's certain teams where if they want a guy, like that's not going to really hang them up. But there's certain other teams that maybe they don't want that draft pick, to lose that draft pick. So it's all, and I think we can kind of talk about all this with the understanding that there's the CBA is expiring on December 1st. And as far as I understand it, teams are just operating status quo until that December 1st. So everything that applied in the CBA that's current, so qualifying offers, those are working the same way. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting what changes, you know, if there's a new deal after December 1st. But as far as I understand it, everyone's just operating status quo because there's no other way to operate.
They can't sit around and do nothing, anticipating labor strife or anticipating, you know, a brand newly constructed CBA. But I don't think it's unfair to think that there are parts and pieces that are going to look a lot different come April, fingers crossed, when the season starts on time. I'm very much in favor in the players getting a good deal and making sure that they are represented well with all of the different revenue streams and not pushed into corners. And then it becomes a matter of like, what are the things that you're willing to negotiate? What are the things that you're willing to trade off if they want different pieces, if there's a growing movement to include higher or better pay for minor leaguers, what's that negotiating piece going to look like? What is it they're going to have to give up if they have to give up anything? But the qualifying offer could definitely be something that is definitely an owner friendly piece. It is something that I don't think it's unfair to say is a bit of a wage suppressant for folks exactly like Steven Matz, because that is going to rule out some teams that might want to be in the Steven Matz business. And then, you know, the dollars per win thing is always interesting, because I don't know that relationship is as strong as it used to be. You know, I think for a long time there were so many of those pre-arbitration deals that were signed, and so many, there's not as many folks get to free agency, and that as baseball's middle class sort of hollowed out a little bit, some of those dollar per win kind of conversions started to be a little odd. But at the same time, I don't think that sticker shock aside, paying $19 million for 1 year of Steven Matz probably shouldn't be too scary. But then the alternative is maybe a deal similar to the one that maybe the Blue Jays signed for Jay Happ, right? When they gave Jay Happ, 3 years and $36 million after Jay Happ sort of had a strong season split between Seattle and Pittsburgh and then re-signed with Toronto ahead of the 2016 season. So, I guess the question is there enough faith in Steven Matz in the market that someone could say, or his agent can say safely, we will turn down this QO and then go off and accept a 3-year deal of 30 or 2 in 24 or whatever it might be. And I think a lot of times it comes down to the individual. And if, you know, I can't remember who it was, somebody recently I saw talking about how free agency was like the worst experience of their life, their professional life. They hated it. They hated the meat market aspect and not knowing, and the season leading up, they really did not enjoy the process. And I don't think that's unique. So if you're Steven Matz and you're like, I do not want to go through this again. I'm not that you don't want to bet on yourself, and not that you don't believe that you can come and build an even better springboard if you sign like a, you know, do what Marcus Semien did effectively. But if you would rather not do that, and you don't think that you're going to be able to perform your best by taking that kind of a risk, then go and get that 2 or 3 year deal if it's out there. So there's a lot of internal calculus, maybe we could say, that surrounds Steven Matz.
Yeah, I think so. Particular. And I think you've laid it out. And it's also interesting, like, about whether he sees some value in just coming back with the Blue Jays for 1 year and giving it another go because he enjoyed playing with them. And if he is confident he can repeat his success, maybe he feels okay taking that somewhat risk of saying, I think I can repeat what I did and set myself up even better. So somewhat, but at the same time, like, you're limited to how many times you can get that big paycheck, as you know, right? Like, so if he feels like this is, you know, I'm coming off one of my better seasons, the timing's great here, and as much as it would be nice to take $20 million right now and know I have a job for next year, like, if you don't have that kind of success, maybe you kind of back yourself into a corner and you lose. So, you know, I think that it actually might be worthwhile for the Blue Jays to extend the offer. If I had to guess, I think he might reject it. And then the Blue Jays are sort of okay, because then they're looking at three players that reject the qualifying offers, and they protect themselves with getting those draft picks back. And it also helps them to somewhat, to your point about suppressing value and suppressing the market a little bit, it does give them somewhat of a leg up in negotiating, maybe less so with Robbie Ray and Marcus Semien because they are just so good, but maybe if with a guy like Steven Matz, where teams are a little bit less, because he's going to be sort of fitting in a more fourth or fifth starter role, maybe teams are a little bit less inclined to you know, offer that draft pick for a guy like him, and maybe it does give the Blue Jays a leg up in negotiating, as you say, a 2 or 3 year deal with Steven Matz.
Yeah, which that's a great point. I really agree that is a bit of a back door for the Blue Jays as well. That if he does decline the deal or the offer, then the Blue Jays still have the inside track potentially to re-sign him, and that's when you start to do similar to what we saw with Robbie Ray, where they got that deal done so quickly last winter because if Steven Matz feels comfortable working with Toronto, working in Toronto, working with Pete Walker and Matt Bushman and the entire team that helped him to become the guy that had this great season in 2021, if he thinks I can replicate that here, and then again, if he wants to do that, or just if he just likes it, right? Again, that's the other thing too. There's lots of options out there. You know, obviously, you know, even his old team, right? The Mets and the Yankees are going to be in the market for starting pitching. Going to be teams that are going to be willing to spend. He's a guy from Long Island, so maybe he wants to go back. Maybe he likes living in the city. Move to Toronto. Move back. Come on, Steven Matz. It's all good. But I think a lot of Blue Jays fans have that kind of Robbie Ray mode in their mind, where they'll be like, just get it done real quick, get him back in at a bit of a cut rate deal, which obviously he's not going to accept, because that's where those differences fall apart, because he had a great season as opposed to like a handful of good starts for Robbie Ray.
It's funny because I've seen the discourse change a little bit in the last little bit, where I felt like maybe not midseason, but certainly July and August, there seemed to be a lot of interest in just bringing Robbie Ray back. Whatever you need to do, bring Robbie Ray back. But I've seen some people sort of shift and say, I was sort of a bring Robbie Ray back person before, and now I'm more in the camp of bring Semien back no matter what it takes. I don't know why that shift has happened, but I've seen a lot of people sort of growing more concerned with whether or not Robbie Ray can repeat his success, and whether it's just the value that Semien provides as an everyday player, maybe the way he ended the season, whereas Robbie Ray was ending the season fine, but not as dominant as he was in July and parts of August, where he was just unhittable. And, you know, I've seen some concern about Robbie Ray. He's a two-pitch pitcher, which is not true. He is a four-pitch pitcher. He just, because the slider and the fastball were working so well for him for a stretch there, and again in July and August, I think, where he was just guys could not tell what was coming out of his hand with those two pitches, and he got away. He didn't need to use the other ones because he was having such success. But I've seen sort of concern about, well, he's a two-pitch pitcher, which I don't think should be necessarily a huge concern for people because he can use the other pitches. I hear people being concerned just generally about, can he repeat his success? I don't know that he can repeat his exact success. It's really hard to come out and have the lowest ERA among all AL starters and, you know, post the kind of numbers that he posted. But I do think that everything that I talked to Robbie Ray about and Pete Walker about in season, and obviously they're going to be a little bit biased, but what he did, the mechanical changes that he made, the delivery that he had, the repeatability of that delivery, I think as long as he doesn't stray from that, the huge walks are probably gone. Like, I think a part of the issue with him with the walks was just he would tinker with his delivery and get out of a rhythm. He seems to have really nipped that. He seems to have really fully embraced that strategy of the Blue Jays where it's like aim for more of the plate and your stuff will play. I can't see him really backing off of that strategy because he's obviously seen it work for an entire season, if not a little more, going back to the latter half of 2020. And so I don't think that there should be concern that he's going to suddenly morph into a guy who has a 15% walk rate. I think those days are probably gone unless something really bad happens or he really kind of gets out of his rhythm. But yeah, certainly you never know with any pitcher whether they can repeat the success. But, you know, I don't know that you can say necessarily that Semien's going to come out and hit 45 home runs again. I mean, it's a lot of home runs. No one's ever done that.
That's a lot of home runs.
No one's ever done that ever. So, but you know, it's just an interesting discourse. I think you could very easily have one of them come back. I think you could see a situation where neither of them comes back. I think you could see a situation where both of them come back. I think if both of them come back, that's going to be the bulk of the work the Blue Jays would do. I think if they both came back, then it means the other additions they're making are more marginal. But at the same time, I don't think the Blue Jays need wholesale changes to their team regardless.
No, you're right. There are, you made the point earlier that, that they like Robbie Ray only gets one shot at this, right? This is Robbie Ray's time to max out his next contract, to figure out what's going to work best for him, where, you know, the wares and the, and there are a million different factors, and but this is his time to get paid. And the one thing I was thinking about also is like his slider is really interesting. I'm kind of backtracking a little bit of something that I was really thinking about, because he is a two pitch pitcher, but a slider is typically a pitch that has a lot of like strong splits. Like, you know, him throwing a slider to right-handers, ordinarily that's a, you know, the slider is a pitch that would work better against left-handed batters versus right-handed batters as a left-handed pitcher. But his slider works so well this year against righties that it's maybe something that to watch, something that maybe will make folks more believers in Robbie Ray, and that his ability to kind of like neutralize those splits by throwing that slider. And even if he is only a two-pitch pitcher, why throw the other ones if they don't work? If you don't need them, if you're able to bury that slider on the back foot and also flip it in, like throw it to both sides of the plate and throw it in the dirt and throw it for a strike, that's a huge weapon. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, and on top of the thing that we're all kind of assuming that you touched on here, which is that Robbie Ray is going to continue to throw strikes. But
these are
the big questions, and I don't think we're going to answer them today. We'll continue to talk about this. Again, Marcus Semien has built an amazing platform. If you go back as far as like 2018, obviously he wasn't the same kind of offensive player in terms of just like raw home runs, but even as in terms of relative to league average, 2018 and then 2019, 2020, when you start to zoom out a little bit, the 2020 blip becomes just like a slump, right? We're talking about a 60 game sample. Then he was even mostly fine in September that month. So it was like a bad month during COVID. So mm-hmm. Marcus Semien has built himself a spectacular platform. And all the people who were giving me a hard time when I was saying that he was going to get George Springer money in like August, all owe me an apology directly. Come to me and apologize. Because, I get why you know, Blue Jays fans do it in particular are like, well, maybe I'd give like 3 years and $60 million to Marcus Semien. It's like, my guy, he is not going to take that. And you know, the fans and even people who aren't fans, if the more money you save, the more money you can spend on somebody else. And if you keep getting all these cut rate deals, your next thing you know, you're going to have a super team built of guys with undervalued contracts. But don't think that's going to be the case for Marcus Semien. The thing that I've spoken with so many folks about here, I remember talking to Arden Zwelling about it in particular, was that, you know, the market paid George Springer as much. This was Arden's point, that like it's not just like a it's not a rational, or it's not an efficient market, right? The market helps to set the price. George Springer got what he got because of that few other players out there, and there were only a certain amount of teams that were looking. With Trevor Story, Corey Seager, Marcus Semien, Carlos Correa, the market's going to look a lot differently. But
yeah, and I think more teams are going to be spending this winter as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe not.
Well, when there's a salary cap, they don't have to worry.
But also, just like, I think that one thing is like the trade deadline and how active it was, and how many teams were buying. Like, I think kind of leads me to believe that there's more teams willing to want to at least make up some revenue lost in the couple seasons where they haven't made as much because of capacity restrictions and all that kind of stuff. There's some inclination to spend a little more, make the team better. And I think just like last year, there was like five teams. Like the whole kind of joke was that the Jays were in on everyone because they were like one of a handful of teams that were actually going to be spending on players. And like, you looked at the offseason, obviously the George Springer deal was a huge bulk of it, but like, they were one of the top spenders, but there really wasn't many teams spending. I think this season there's just going to be more available players, and there's probably going to be more teams spending. So I would agree that like, there's not, as much as the arbitration system is kind of flawed, it is a system in which you use comps and you come up with salaries based on comps. That doesn't exist in free agency. Teams do that internally. They say, okay, this player is like this player, and this is what we value him as, and this is what we'll go to, and this is the term we'll go to, and this is our offer, and take it or leave it kind of thing. Like, teams do that, but there's not a arbiter that comes in and says, okay, this is what you have to take. Like, that doesn't exist in free agency. It's all up to the player and the team and to figure out that. And so obviously with Springer, like, the Blue Jays were willing to go $150 million over 6 years. Would they be willing to do that for Semien? Like, potentially, if they did it 1 year early, potentially not, because they now have to consider, you know, other guys on their roster, and Vladdy's going to start making a lot more money now, and Bo Bichette's going to start making a lot more money soon, and they've got to consider extensions for some of their young guys. Also Berríos, if they want to keep him, and like, there's all these more considerations that they have to consider. That
wasn't a great, I'm glad you said Jose Berríos. I think that he is as good an extension candidate as there is. Teoscar Hernandez is another, you know, guy that is playing himself into that conversation. Love Teoscar Hernandez, and he's building up quite the platform to earn a hefty raise, because there's more and more signal and less noise when we start to look back at, like, how long has Teoscar Hernandez been this guy, and as there's more and more evidence to suggest that this is who he is now, as opposed to. Because I think on its own, 2021 might stand out a little bit. He hit for a high average, still didn't strike out quite as much, but didn't really walk, hit for a lot of power. There's a lot of, it's an interesting profile, a little bit on the unique side. More Spin Rate coming up right after these words from our sponsors.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
One guy I saw you mentioned in your column, in your off-season preview column, was Corey Dickerson. And what do you think about Corey Dickerson? What do you think about the prospect of bringing a guy like Corey Dickerson back?
Well, I guess why it made me sort of pause is just because of something that Ross Atkins said in his end of season press conference with the media a couple, it would have been last week, was just about their preference to diversify the offense a little bit. And so obviously it's no secret that the Blue Jays have a right-handed heavy offense. And for a lot of reasons that works for them. They have an overwhelmingly aggressive offense. And again, that really worked for them. They hit for power. They don't strike out. They put the ball in play. They hit a lot of first pitches. They do all those things and they do them very well. And so there's not really, again, like, the offense doesn't need wholesale changes. It does need some variety. And so Ross Atkins talked about sort of two things. One, bringing in a few more left-handed batters, if only just to make teams think a little bit more about what pitchers they deploy, especially like late in innings where we've seen the Blue Jays sometimes struggle a little bit because a hard-throwing reliever can just come in and kind of pound the strike zone, throw sliders, and they are very aggressive and they swing and, whatnot. So diversifying the lineup with a left-handed hitter, and you saw, like, Corey Dickerson, have some of those really good at-bats hitting down on the lineup a little bit. He put the ball in play. He was definitely, in September, a pretty effective hitter for the Blue Jays. And then another element they need is, which isn't necessarily Corey Dickerson, but another element they need is a little bit more patience in their lineup. They don't have a ton of guys that walk. They didn't walk very much as a team. Part of that is because they simply just hit the ball a lot. Like, they just hit for average. They get on base a lot, but they get on base a lot by putting balls in play. And so they don't have a ton of guys that take a huge amount of walks. So if you added some of that, so guys that more lean towards on-base percentage as opposed to hitting for average, maybe that helps your lineup. And the thing that's sick too, like, I was looking at this, like, Blue Jays don't see a lot of pitches. Like, if you look at, like, the average number of pitches per plate appearance, it's one of the lowest in the league. Part of that is because they hit the first pitch so much. They just, you know, their at-bats are short. And so they actually, like, average fewer than four pitches per plate appearance. They don't have guys that take a lot of walks. And so if you add that, you know, is that Kevin Biggio writing himself, or do you add to the lineup as well? So I guess Corey Dickerson was more the former thing I was talking about, was just like, you know, you have to add left-handed bats. And I, to be honest, I haven't done my full deep dives yet on, like, who's going to be out there. This was more just like taking a look at, like, what do the Blue Jays have? What decisions do they have sort of pertaining to their own roster? And, like, is there any interesting candidates that you want to bring back? So I haven't done a full deep dive of, like, okay, who are the other, like, left-handed bats that are going to be available? And what does it mean for the Blue Jays? But I think if you just looked at the roster and, like, Corey Dickerson, he's a nice complement to, like, Randall Grichuk, platoon partner. So it's just something like, you know, do you bring him back?
I don't think it's a bad question to ask. My thing with Corey Dickerson, and I've been thinking about this a little bit recently, actually, is that my problem with Corey Dickerson is that, like, the value I see in him and when why, you know, Ross Atkins might have brought him up and the points that you've just made is that, like, it's, you know what you're getting, mm-hmm. right? Like, Corey Dickerson is there. He's in the mix. He was part of the team. If everybody's cool with him, if he gets along, if, you know, they know what he offers, but that is why I am what would be much, 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 much more inclined to wait. I am not in a hurry to get Corey Dickerson locked back up because I don't think it would be very difficult to find someone who does the similar things to Corey Dickerson, but does many or all of them better mm-hmm. because Corey Dickerson doesn't really do anything well, I think, is kind of the problem. He can catch a fly ball playing left field, can't throw it, didn't really hit for power, didn't even really hit for that much of like an average. Again, he is a worthwhile kind of counterpoint or antidote to the Blue Jays kind of sameness. Mm-hmm. But I think that there are lots of options to make an upgrade with a guy who's not unlike that, but maybe does some of the other things better.
Right. Yeah. And I agree with that.
And if you can get so there were some rumors that were coming around that came out this week. I think it might have been Shai Davidi who had been writing about it, that the Blue Jays were in fact in on Jose Ramirez at the trade deadline, as well as Robbie Grossman. Now, Robbie Grossman is an interesting name to me. I think that he kind of fits that bill. He can play almost all the outfield positions. He does hit left-handed at least some of the time. I don't know if he's a switch hitter. I don't think he is, but in my head, I'm not sure. But like a guy like that is a bit of a souped up version of Dickerson that you could get at a relatively low acquisition cost and kind of address those problems and take care of those problems with a little bit more upside, I guess is maybe the angle that I'll take. Here's another name that I'm just going to throw out, and I'm going to look it up to see if it's even feasible. Okay. Max Kepler. Oh, he's got a big contract. Yeah, even more. All the better. Max Kepler. Bring me Max Kepler. I'm into that. He's German. He's a German big leaguer. Can you believe it? Bring him around. Max Kepler signed a 5-year deal that takes him with a team option for 2024. It's dirt cheap. So he would be expensive. He would cost a lot. His acquisition cost would be much higher because his contract is so team friendly. 28 years old though, just finished his age 28 season. But what does Minnesota want? Does Minnesota want to be good or do they want to be bad? If they want to be good, they should keep Max Kepler. But anyway, now what else? What else is on the horizon in the offseason? We got award season, mm-hmm. which you'll hear lots from us because the Blue Jays players can expect to be busy during award season.
Yeah, I think so. I think they'll at least be busy for a couple of them. I think we can sort of speculate that Alek Manoah could, you know, gain a vote or two for Rookie of the Year. I don't think he spent enough time in the majors. I think Rookie of the Year, which, full disclosure, I voted for this year. I won't reveal my vote. But I did vote. And the thing that's not unlike MVP, but a little bit different than MVP, is that, like, Rookie of the Year, you're putting position players against pitchers. And so, I mean, like with the MVP, you know, you do have the Cy Young Award. So a lot of people will steer towards position players, or mm-hmm. if you're the Angels pitcher / position player, both.
Why not both?
But generally speaking, MVP, you know, a lot of the time will go to a position player because Cy Young goes to the pitcher. So, but rookie is, you have to pick one rookie, run standout rookie, and you're comparing position players. And so sometimes it's hard when there's a position player and he's playing 140, 150 games for his team, and you're comparing to a starter that made 20 starts like Alek Manoah. It's, you mm-hmm. know, it's hard to say, well, this, you have to really, really stand out. But I do think that, like, he is certainly probably gained consideration. I certainly considered him when I was making my decision. And so I think that, you know, we might hear his name said. I think manager of the year is always one of those things where it's really hard to predict. It's usually like, I've never voted for it, but like, I think writers have a hard time voting for it. And you kind of have to like, just go by team performance and kind of like, which manager led a team that I didn't think was necessarily...
Exactly. Unexpected team performance.
Yes.
Did not expect that team to be as good. They must have a brilliant manager. And then the guy gets fired the next year.
Yeah. So.
Which is like Rocco Baldelli, who won manager of the year a couple of years ago. And now his job is a little bit in jeopardy in Minnesota. The rookie thing is interesting, and I like the way that Keith Law has explained the way that he votes on it, where Keith Law tries to find the balance. I don't want to put too many words in his mouth, but between like the performance, but also the trajectory. Like,
right.
This is a good opportunity to reward a future star or like get someone on more folks' radar because he is going to figure prominently into like the story of the game in the next couple of years, which, you know, so to avoid maybe like his example, I think that he uses all the time, is like Angel Barroa, who was like an older rookie who won and then didn't have much of a career. And it's okay. How much do you weigh playing time versus performance? And that's where sort of the wins above replacement as a model kind of might fall apart a little bit, because Alek Manoah pitched, I think, better than Casey Mize, but he didn't pitch as much. Mm-hmm. And he didn't pitch he pitched not quite as well as Luis Garcia, but maybe, and didn't pitch as much. So it's like, that starts to get harder to make the case for him over yes. Garcia.
Yeah.
And then it's, okay, what about Wander Franco versus Randy Rosarena? Like, Ron DeFranco is a star. Like, he already is a star. We don't even have to imagine what it's going to be like. He had another home run tonight. The last time I checked, it was 5-3 for the Red Sox. Yep. But, like, so do you vote for Franco because he is the next big thing in the game? Or do you vote for Rosarena, who is, you know, kind of famous for his postseason exploits? Shout out to that steal of home. That was the one that I was like, man, this Rays, I don't know how anyone can ever beat them. And the Red Sox are like, oh, we just hit home runs when we need to. And then we win. So that's a tough one. It's tough because I think Manoah deserves, if nothing else, like a down ballot shout. You know, if I'm not sure it is, you only vote for three,
which is tough. And I think when I was like evaluating, like you could come up with a solid list of five that I think you could make the case that are deserving of some recognition for their rookie season. Mm-hmm. I did like just to underline, like I do like Keith's point, kind of what you said, but almost like also just capturing the essence of the award, which is you also want to take into account age sometimes, like to do something at age 20, like someone like Wander Franco is doing, as opposed to sometimes you can have rookies that are like 28. And, you know, not to say that age should dictate how we evaluate players and whatnot, but, you know, you should kind of credit someone who's doing what they're doing at such a young age. And like Wander Franco, I mean, he's just, it's not like a, you know, a fluke. Like he's going to be a star, you say. So like this, or I like Keith's way of looking at it, like you want it, the essence of the award is to capture, you know, a true rookie performance that, again, is someone who you think has lasting staying power. It is a tough, I voted for rookie of the year. It's my comfort zone, honestly.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't know. I've done it now a few times, so like I kind of feel comfortable doing it. I guess it would be in some ways, like I said, like it's not necessarily easier to vote for any of them, but if you are voting for Cy Young, for example, at least you're only considering more or less starting pitching. I guess sometimes a reliever stands out so much that he can earn the award, but most years it goes to the best starting pitcher.
When was the last reliever to win? That's a great question. I agree with that, the piece about age as well, because Vlad, as an example, doesn't get credit in the Cy Young. He shouldn't get extra credit in the Cy Young race for being the MVP race. Yeah, because that's the other guy. He shouldn't get credit in the MVP race for being young, right? But in the Rookie of the Year criteria, I can see that fitting into that. Man, Rick Porcello won the Cy Young. What the fuck? So I get that. I think that's a fair bit of thing to consider. Now, these aren't supposed to be long shows, but here we are.
Well, we just have two more awards to go.
And two more awards to go. Okay.
Cy Young. I think it's going to be a tight finish between Robbie Ray and Gerrit Cole. Just kind of reading the sort of online, you know, like outlets kind of vote for their Cy Young winners unofficially. I think Jason Stark typically does a piece where he kind of goes over who he would vote for all the awards. I think he picked Robbie Ray over Gerrit Cole. And I think it really did come down to the finish. And they both kind of wobbled a little bit down the stretch in September. But ERA goes to Robbie Ray. Innings pitch, which is a big one, also goes to Robbie Ray. I think he made more starts. I think in terms of like counting numbers, I think Robbie Ray had the most strikeouts. I think rate stats skew more towards Gerrit Cole. So like, you know, strikeouts per nine, walks per nine, and home runs was a bit of a trouble spot for Robbie Ray. I think you can probably put some of that in perspective of where he was pitching. So Dunedin and Buffalo were obviously more hitter-friendly ballparks. If you look at his numbers at the Rogers Center, for example, they're really good. I think he stands a good chance. I think it's going to be pretty close. I think that Gerrit Cole is probably going to get some first place votes. For some people, like I think Keith Law, when he did his evaluation, he had Gerrit Cole first, I believe, and Robbie Ray third. So I don't know that Robbie Ray is, I don't think it would be an unanimous either way, whoever wins. I can see in a scenario where Gerrit Cole just edges out Robbie Ray perhaps, but I do think it, I do, my leaning is like, my thinking is it's going to go to Robbie Ray, but that's just kind of guessing based on sort of most of the discourse that I've heard and read about it.
I think that he deserves it.
Yeah. I think also like you shouldn't, this shouldn't come into play, but the narrative of Robbie Ray is so much better for a Cy Young winner. Actually, like, you know, and Gerrit Cole has not won the Cy Young. He's kind of been a pitcher that has been close, but just hasn't won it. You know, there's been maybe one guy better than him, but I'm sure he will win the Cy Young at some point. But Robbie Ray's narrative of going from a pitcher who, you know, walked more guys than the entire league and then comes back this year and is, you know, the best pitcher in baseball per ERA, like that's a really great story. Like that's a really great narrative and it shouldn't really play into voters' minds, you know, but I think if you're kind of writing the like Disney movie around it, you would pick Robbie Ray.
There's too much grunting and those pants are too tight for a Disney movie. Gerrit Cole, you're right, did not win the Cy Young in 2019, which almost surprised me. He struck out 326 guys that year. 326 strikeouts. He had a 185 ERA plus. He did not pitch as many innings as his teammate, Justin Verlander, who, of course, won the Cy Young in 2019 in the American League. And I will note that the last reliever, I'm a fool for forgetting, the last reliever to win the Cy Young was Eric Gagne, who won it.
Oh, was he actually the last? I thought there might have been someone in between.
No, I obviously don't remember these things as well as I thought. Eric Gagne won the Cy Young in 2003. He got 28 first place votes and took it home. With his, you know, incredible season, he pitched 82 innings that year, but he got 55 saves. He had a 337 ERA plus, which is pretty good. He struck out 137 guys in 82 innings. But Jason Schmidt had a bonkers year that year. You know, and so did Mark Pryor. Mark Pryor and Jason Schmidt both had great years. I don't know that Eric Gagne wins that in 2023. You know, that Eric Gagne season, which again, you can think back to another, like 2006, when, so the year that I exclaimed about that Rick Porcello, of all people, won the Cy Young, that was the year that Zach Britton had a shout, right? Zach Britton had his
ERA. So it's 2016.
Oh my God. Zach Britton's ERA that year was 0.54, which translates in ERA plus, where 100 is league average. His ERA plus that year was 803, which is that's a crazy number. I've never seen one that high of anyone who's pitched more than like two innings. Gagne, or Britton had a crazy year that year, but still, you know, worth four wins above replacement by Baseball Reference, which for pitchers, I think is a bit of a better measure in terms of, especially for evaluation, for awards, right? So I don't know what anyone is thinking at home, but again, if we want to bring it back to Robbie Ray, Baseball Reference is based on runs allowed, not based on FIP, which is maybe if you want to look forward, who's going to be better into the future based on their ability to prevent home runs and then have a greater differential between strikeouts and walks. That's a forward-looking number from my mind. Fangraphs wins above replacement, Baseball Reference, all about just keeping runs off the board. And by that measure, Robbie Ray outpaces Gerrit Cole by a significant amount, even with the error bars that are built into wins above replacement that sometimes we forget a little bit about. My resolution is I'm not going to use fractions in wins above replacement anymore because okay. It just, that implies a specificity that isn't built into that, that calculation. So if you had a 4-win year, you had a 5-win year, Robbie Ray effectively had a 7-win year between 6 and 7. And Cole was more in the 5-6 range. So
do you know, I'm sure you know who, but do you know when the last Blue Jays Cy Young winner was and who it was?
It was Roger Clemens. No, it was Jorge Halladay in 2003.
Yes.
Yes.
I was looking this up and I forgot because I was a small child, so I wouldn't have remembered. Easy. But 96, 97, 98, 3 years mm-hmm. back to back. A Blue Jays pitcher won the Cy Young. First, it was Pat Hankin, who won in 96 for the first time a Blue Jays pitcher won the Cy Young. And then Roger Clemens won back to back years.
Those Roger Clemens years are not discussed a lot because I think it's a bit of like a black hole.
Yeah, it's like a little bit of a sore spot, I think.
It's a bit of a sore spot. But if you just look at the numbers, if you go to Baseball Reference and you look at the Blue Jays record book, those seasons were so truly insane. Like unbelievable, the numbers that he put up and the amount that he pitched and the strikeouts. One of my favorite games. So you're ready? I'm about to age myself right in front of you here, Caitlin. I went to a game on Canada Day in 1997. So I was not 19 yet. This is noteworthy for how the rest of the night went that we won't talk about. But that was the first year of Interleague, and that was the first. Is it the first year of Interleague? Maybe not. Maybe it wasn't the first. I went to watch Roger Clemens play face off against Jeff Juden on Canada Day at the Rogers Center. And it was a great game. And Juden edged out Roger Clemens. Roger Clemens gave up 2 runs in 8 1/3 innings and 10 hits. One was a home run to Rondell White. Shout out to Rondell White. And then the Blue Jays lost 2-1. It was one of the best games I've ever seen in my life. Jeff Juden struck out 14. He went an inning and 8 1/3 innings as well. And then Ugueth Urbina, who has some shady stuff happened to him after his baseball career. But Jeff Juden, who I don't remember anything else about other than that he pitched his ass off on Canada Day that year. And then I went to many bars that should not have allowed me in. But I had the time of my life on Canada Day. 1997, when you were a very small child, if a human being at all.
I was a human being, yes. No, good. Right, so I think it's safe to say that Robbie Ray potentially is going to become the third Blue Jays pitcher, but fourth time in Blue Jays history to win the Cy Young. Mm-hmm. We'll see. And then the last award, obviously we've talked about this a lot on this podcast, but just to cap things off, MVP, where I think the Blue Jays will feature prominently in the runner-up categories, whereas I think there's a pretty good chance, if not a great chance, that Vlad will finish second, and I think Marcus Semien will finish third. I think
that Vlad will get a couple first-place votes.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think I can't see him getting more than a few third-place votes. Like, he's going to get the bulk of the second place votes, like 25 or 26.
I think that there's probably some voters who, you know, kind of look at what Shohei Ohtani did down the stretch, where in the sense that he wasn't as dominant as he was in the first half, and Vladdy had a pretty strong finish. Obviously, he didn't get the Blue Jays to the postseason, but he got them as close as possible without getting them there. Yeah, I think he'll just probably earn a couple of first place votes. But I agree with you. I think that you could almost say that I don't think you can get second place unanimously. Maybe you can, but I think he will get the bulk of the second place votes. And I would say that I think Simeon's going to get the bulk of the third place votes and maybe a handful of second place votes. If I don't know, people are really mixing it up a little bit. But the MVP is a tough one to vote for, because you got to put 10 people down. So you really got to go down the list. You can see a Teoscar Hernandez couple votes on there potentially.
It's so fun, truthfully, because that's when you get the wild down ballot stuff. I love it. I love the down ballot nonsense. It's so much fun. I'd be surprised. I mean, who else is there in the American League that might steal a second place or a third place vote? Like, who are you going to, like, Carlos Correa? Carlos Correa actually finished with a higher wins above replacement than both Semien and Guerrero in the American League.
Baseball reference,
right, yeah. I guess likes his defense maybe a little bit more. I'm a big believer in also sometimes you can, a little bit of a hack, you can use, there is a win probability number called, like, what's it called? Base outs runs added. And if you base out runs added, which is almost like a kind of a clutch metric, and you can kind of plug that into the WAR calculation instead of the just regular old batting runs, because you want to maybe reward guys who hit in the clutch, I guess, mm-hmm. if that is your measure of MVP. So sometimes that can change things a little bit. That doesn't help Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in particular, who was not an excessively clutch performer this season, although he obviously led the team in win probability added because he just got on base so much that it just overwhelmed the moments when he wasn't able to rise to the occasion in that way. But measure, Shohei Ohtani was the clutchest hitter in the American League because he got so many walks and had some big hits.
He's going to win.
He is going to win. He had a great last couple weeks too. He bumped his numbers right back up, just like Vlad did. Shout out to Vladimir Guerrero Jr. for no other reason than he finished the season with an OPS over 1,000.
Yes, he did. He got it up there at the end. That's a good question. I mean, I don't know that there's a lot of people. I'm pretty confident in saying 1-2 is almost certainly going to be Shohei and Vlad. I mean, Aaron Judge maybe, but I don't think that he will get any second place votes. You know, if anything, I think he's probably maybe in the top five, but
I think that he would get votes. I think there could be some vote splitting with Stanton, with Stanton's kind of heroics down the stretch. I think Correa might steal a few votes just because Houston was so good. I think that Stanton and Judge, I think Judge deserves votes as well. And then after that, it just starts to get into a bit of like a dealer's choice.
There's probably a Red Sox. I don't know if it's like Bogarts or I don't know who.
Yeah, again, who would be the MVP of the Red Sox? Who's the MVP of the Rays? Who's the Rays' best player this year? You give it to who? A Rosarena,
maybe?
I don't know. And same with like Chicago. Do you give it to Jose Abreu, who won last year? Is he going to grab your votes? Obviously, that team had a rough go with injuries and missed Luis Robert for huge chunks of the season, and Eloy Jimenez as well. They are an interesting bunch. So it could be anything. Or what about like some Kyle Seager or something like that? Again, for the storybook Seattle Mariners. But no, it doesn't really matter. Ohtani's going to win. I'm going to get Cam, the producer Cam, to pull up, maybe not for this episode, but for another episode, my ad read from March when I was like, bet your money on Shohei Ohtani winning the MVP. Yeah. My finest hour. I've had a million bad takes in my life. I've had a million ridiculous predictions, but this is the one that I will hang my hat on for as long as I can.
People are going to have to write you thank you cards if you won them a lot of money.
Maybe just put a little bit of a check in there. Yeah. Just slide your boy a couple bucks with our friends at BetMGM. I don't know if BetMGM is a sponsor anymore. They were before, so shout out. That's it, Caitlin. You know what? We should get out of here. We should get out.
Let's just finish off with saying, though, as we're finishing our recording, the Rays have tied it.
Oh, my God.
Inning, it's 5-5. And Wander Franco is up with a man on second and no outs.
It would delight me to no end if Kevin Kiermaier could just not anymore.
But he did.
He did. And Zunino. And Randy Arozarena.
He's been a main character. Kevin Kiermaier always finds his way. I mean, he's a really good defender. But
he can't hit at all. I don't know how he's doing this to the Red Sox. He cannot hit. He is the main character on the Rays, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
With his red ass. He can really go get it. But the Rays. You can't count them out, even though you may delight in doing exactly that. Caitlin, anything else coming up? Any other off-season guides or things that folks want to know? Well, number one, if they want to read your breakdown of the off-season, of the guide, and looking ahead to what's coming up in the off-season, you and I only got into November. There's still all kinds of – we haven't even talked about the 40-man, which we're not going to, because I would rather – the Rule 5, non-tender. There's a few non-tender candidates in the mix, but I don't know. Some pitcher, some reliever, 40-man roster crunch. Some guys are going to need to get at it, I suppose. That's another story for another day, but you can read that, of course. And what else has Caitlin written? Oh, that we can. This, maybe we'll talk about this thing. 10 things we learned about the Blue Jays. We got the 10-step plan for a successful offseason. This is all fodder for next future episodes. So read all of Caitlin's offseason listicling. by going to theathletic.com/spinrate and subscribing. Caitlin, got anything else you're going to plug? Anything big staring down the pike other than vacation?
No, I'm not on vacation yet. So I will have some content coming out this week. Some stuff kind of focused on some of like the overview that I did. And then I'll kind of dive in on some bigger questions. Obviously, the two main ones being, do you bring back Sim, or not do you bring back, but sort of just the question around Simeon returning and Robbie Ray returning, and, you know, what can sway them and what could potentially lead them to another team and all that kind of stuff. So we'll have that. And yeah, lots of off-season lists. That's what you get in the off-season, lists.
Bless them all. Bless all the lists. Oh, BetMGM is a sponsor of this week's show. Sweet. Her name is Caitlin McGrath. Read her at The Athletic. My name is Drew Fairservice. And we will keep rolling on with more off-season spin rate. But we want to thank you for tuning in this week. Thank you for making the first season a smashing success by any metric, which is to say that I had a lot of fun doing it. So I wouldn't ask for anything else from Caitlin, who is getting her podcasting trial by fire every week and doing a wonderful job. So her name is Caitlin. My name is Drew. We will talk to you next time. It's been a while.